The Nyman family had five brothers and one sister. They emigrated from Warsaw after the war. They had spent the war in the Russian East, evading the Nazi assault. And when they came to New England, they were mechanically trained. And eventually, in the 60s, they started a machine shop, which became quite successful, especially with defense contracts. When I was young in the 80s, I would visit my grandfather's shop not many years before it finally closed. And it provided a great income for the family and had made them somewhat wealthy. And a couple of days ago, I was watching a TV show that had a scene in a machine shop, and I could smell it. I could smell the oil, I could smell the hot metal. I didn't expect to get so choked up about that. But that's a kind of misremembering or misalignment of the senses, which is called synesthesia. It's the same principle. What are two things that have a top note, a middle note, and a bottom note?
A chord.
What else has a top note, a middle note, and a bottom note? Perfume. Because we hear it in a certain way. We hear the smells of a perfume, and the Economist points out in its description of synesthesia that using the word note to describe an odor may be more than just metaphor. There are those fortunate few who can see music, sometimes represented in colors, sometimes in patterns. One even has done animated videos of what she experiences when watching John Coltrane, which, wonderfully enough, was very similar to what I experience. And this parasha, when we talk about the experience of revelation at Sinai, that imagery, that potent combination of senses is expressed succinctly in a few places, most notably that the Israelites ro'im et hakolot, they saw the thunders, they saw the sounds, something theoretically that's impossible to do, but capturing the moment of synesthesia at which the epiphany, the revelation of the divine, the theophany, to use a fancy term, is so much more powerful than words can express. So we think about that mishmash of senses as a way to describe the indescribable, that God answered in thunder, and that there was no image that could describe God in the heavens, on the earth, or even in the waters. So as I mentioned, that Richard Elliot Friedman will be lecturing, speaking to us in about 2.5 months, two plus months. And one of the things I talked to him about in terms of finding a subject that would be suitable for us, something that interests me, is the question of what were the speakers, the reciters of the Torah, expecting their audience to hear and experience? What message did they think would be heard at its time, in its own context of 2.5 to 3 millennia ago? Did they believe in the supernatural and the miraculous? And Dr. Friedman says certainly they did. Or, in my impression, were they trying to convey something that surpassed and defied speech? And so they used the language of the mysterious and ineffable to try to describe an experience that defied explanation. And so this potent imagery, this potent notion of synesthesia, I think, percolates and is laced through the text in various places, even unto Midrash, even unto the later rabbinic tellings of stories of theophany and revelation. So from last week's parasha of the redemption at the sea to this week's parasha of the revelation at Sinai, the Exodus Rabbah, the collection of Midrash, says, "Come and see, the ways of God are not the ways of man. A king could not wage war and be a scribe at the same time and a teacher of children all at once. But God does. For just yesterday at the Reed Sea, or for in our case just last week in our reading, God was like a person at war," says God is one of war. "And today at Revelation, God descends to teach children Torah." The word is used that describes God descending, and I think the image they're even drawing is God sort of sitting cross-legged in a preschool to teach our small human minds the wit and wisdom of our tradition. And this is, I think, one of the most challenging pieces of religion and faith more broadly, is understanding. Now, if you were a polytheist, it would be easier, right? There's a God for storms, there's a God for good, there's a God for wickedness, there's a God for commerce. You don't have to compact your mind to accept the idea that there is one Almighty in charge of all. It's almost unfathomable to the human mind and rationality. I think that's an essential challenge of any faith, but all the more so in a monotheistic system, where it all has to come from one unitary point. And I think we experience that stress most acutely when we deal with evil or suffering. That it all has to come from God, as the Germans say, alles ist Gott, Gott ist alles, right? Did I get that even close to right? We struggle with that. The idea that the good that comes to us and the wickedness all originate in some sort of primary quantum field, in the cosmic microwave background radiation, which is also God. And the Midrash also relates to this. It says, God does everything all together. God puts to death and brings to life at the same time, which is to say, just as there are those among us who are ill, there are those among us who are giving birth. God wounds and heals at the same time, which is to say that at the very same moment that people are dying in war and crisis, there are those who are exiting a hospital. If there's a woman giving birth, or people going to the sea, or persons traveling through deserts, or those incarcerated, and one might be in the east, and one might be in the west, one is in the north, and one is in the south, God hears and knows them all simultaneously. As Isaiah says, Yotzer or urechoshech ose shalom urei ra, ani Adonai ose kol ele. There is one who creates light, and one who makes darkness, making completion or peace, and one who makes wickedness, and I am the one who does all of those things. We don't pause to consider that in the same way we don't pause to consider the idea of 10 commandments, which are really 14 verbs. The idea that it all is one thing, and it's mind-blowing, and I think, frankly, discomforting. We want God to be in charge of bunnies but not foxes, but it just don't work that way. And then I think that poses a real fundamental challenge to faith. The ability to believe that the world has meaning and substance and an architect when we see unwarranted, unmerited suffering, when we see children ailing, when we see true, unrepentant evil flourishing. Because those all happen, right? I don't want to pretend those aren't real things. There are theological options to say, well, that's just a misperception of things. Those are real. To me. And the biblical explanations, the ideas of volcano and earthquake and seas parting, we no longer swallow as literal representations. So how do we still adhere to and be passionate about our religion and our faith? How do we live our faith in an era, frankly, of maturity, where our adulthood has outstripped our belief, so to speak, that we've grown past an ability to naively accept the stories we were told at bedside. I say occasionally that being a father is a great teaching for being a rabbi, because my kids will ask me things about God and Torah, and I have to give them an explanation that I believe, that they can understand, and that will suit them again in 10 years when they need a new explanation. That will not cause a break in their faith. It's a challenge. I wish Bernard was here. Paul Ricoeur, is that how you say his name? The philosopher? Ricoeur? Okay. So Paul Ricoeur, the French philosopher writing mostly in the 20th century, who died in 2005, talks about this concept called the second naivete. That we start as children, and the stories of Noah's Ark seem totally plausible. Like, you can definitely fit millions of animals in one boat. Why not? Smallish boat. And then sometime when we're 16, we realize it can't be that way. As actually even younger, Gabe says to me last Friday, I don't remember what the question, what the setup was, but he says, "So has Shabbat been observed for 4.6 billion years?" And I said, I'm very eager. I said, "We'll talk about it at Kiddush," and then neither one of us followed up. And the other day I was, I wanted to talk to Gabe about that so badly. So Gabe's already at that stage, where the literalist and the plain sense answer of scripture and tradition isn't enough. But I think Gabe makes a beautiful Jew. And I think Jewish tradition is extremely rich and can withstand that kind of critical assault. So what Ricoeur calls it is the second naivete, sort of a suspended disbelief. You know, you go to see the Avengers, you don't really think there's a guy who can swing a hammer that's so powerful he can fly. No one's Thor, talking Thor. No one? Okay, fine. It's a movie. It's a very silly movie, right? But you don't go into it expecting that you're going to meet Thor somewhere. He's out there. But you still want to see the movie. Right? You don't, and as I said before, just because Rick and Rick's Café Américain never existed in Casablanca doesn't mean that the movie isn't perfect. Right? That it speaks of a truth deeper than fact. So Ricoeur, I think, essentially says in the second naivete is that it's sort of a suspension of disbelief would be a shorthand way of saying it, that you say, I can't disavow my rational mind, but I still treasure the wisdom contained within my tradition and my faith. And although these issues of the broadness of God and the difficulty of holding together two seemingly opposite ideas, that God is good and that there is evil in the world, cause me great distress, I won't give up. That's what adult faith is about. And I want to tell you, I think, that that is not new. Heschel said, and as a report about Revelation, the Bible itself is a midrash. If we talk about Revelation and we understand Torah to be a description of events and theophany at Sinai, it's already telling a story. It's already on an allegorical or at least metaphoric level, and it understands itself to be, and certainly Heschel did, that we can't expect text to be revealing to us things that surpass intuition and surpass writing. It's impossible to contain the experience of the divine in words, and our text is sort of grasping at an effort to contain all of God'sness. And then there's a Hasidic teaching. So I think part of it is creating in oneself or allowing in oneself a second naivete, not sort of a vile doublethink, but the ability to say, yes, logically, this isn't what I understand, but that doesn't dismay me and my faith. So the Hasidic masters have a teaching based on the idea that this was on the third day was revelation, that people waited 3 days. And they say that the number three is very significant in our tradition, and I don't know if they've read Hegel and Marx on this, but they're basically quoting that idea of thesis, antithesis, and synthesis. That you start with an idea, you have a counterpoint, and then you try to meld them. So the Hasidic master says the one, the number one, implies exclusivity or singularity. The number two is about diversity and plurality. And the number three is a state in which the diversity of two is surpassed by an overarching truth. That what we have to do as in our mature and grown-up faith is to come to a third truth, that it is neither faith nor reason, that they aren't necessarily in tension with each other, that it is neither good nor bad, but we have to be able to hold everything within a third overarching schema. It's worthwhile learning to juggle, because if you can keep both sides in your field of view, you can learn to hold opposing viewpoints, just as we ought in our political lives. And that piece of faith, I want to leave you with a midrash and then a quote from our parasha. Do you know why the Torah was given in the desert? One of our earlier midrashim says, it teaches us that if you don't surrender yourself to it like a desert, you don't merit the words of Torah. Which I think is intimating that Faith cannot be obtained rationally. There is something here that supersedes our mind, and that we have to ingest and absorb and embrace the tensions and the polarities and the manifold ways in which God expresses God's self in our lives and allow it. And then we move forward with that faith. The parsha in the chapter 19, verse 8 says that the people say, "All that is spoken, we will do." The idea of moving forward without question. Not like I said, absorbing that there are 10 commandments without question, but just saying, I don't have all the information, I can't prove any of this, and still I will accept and move forward. I'm not going to be paralyzed by the questions either. So I don't have a clear moral to this fable. It's more of just an idea that to re-embrace faith in adulthood and maturity is a process that requires surrendering ourselves to the mystery beyond us and anticipating in our openness to new ideas and epiphany the possibility that we will reach a new understanding.